This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. A forerunner of Afropunk named Opal, who's an unapologetically black feminist from Detroit, and a withdrawn white British singer-songwriter named Nev are the improbable duo at the center of the new novel, The Final Revival of Opal and Nev, written by my guest, Donnie Walton. The story is told in the form of an oral history written in 2015 by Sonny Curtis, the first black editor-in-chief of the music magazine Oral, that's a rival to Rolling Stone. Sonny's father was the drummer for Opal and Nev when they got together in the early 70s. He was killed during a riot at a music showcase where Opal and Nev performed on the same bill as a southern rock band known for wearing Confederate flags and for attracting a rowdy audience of bikers. Sonny's motivation in doing this oral history is to find out more about her father, who died just before she was born. Fresh Air's book critic Maureen Corrigan said she had to make sure that the final revival of Opal and Nev wasn't a true account of a real-life rock duo from the 70s. That's how authentic this odd novel feels. The Washington Post Review described the novel as a dazzling triumph. Donnie Walton drew on her own experiences as an editor at Essence, Entertainment Weekly, Getty Images, and Life. She grew up in Jacksonville, Florida, and lives in Brooklyn. Donnie Walton, welcome to Fresh Air. I really enjoyed your novel.
Thank you so much, Terry. I'm honored to be here.
So I'd like you to describe Opal and Nev as a music duo, what they both represent musically and why they're such an unlikely pairing.
Sure. So Opal and Nev, they are an interracial duo. Opal is a Black American woman from Detroit. She's a singer, and she's not the best singer, but she definitely has an X factor, that thing that you can't put a finger on that makes her fascinating to watch. She's a wonderful performer. And Nev sort of discovers her at a Detroit amateur hour. He's a white Englishman from Birmingham, and he's a bit of a quirky songwriter. He starts in the folky tradition, but he has some chameleonic tendencies. So as trends change, as music change, Nev tends to change with those things. And they get famous together in 1971 through a riot that occurs at one of their concerts, and it's launches them into a spotlight, and they become a little radicalized. So they're making music that's a little ahead of their time, a little bit punk, and it's very political in nature, and they are only able to last for a couple of years that way, and then they sort of go their separate ways.
Did you have real musicians in mind when you created Opal and Nev?
I absolutely did, especially for Opal. I had three that were really key inspirations for me. There was Grace Jones, mostly for her style and her performance art. There was Nona Hendrix, who was one third of the group LaBelle, who were a great funk rock trio in the 1970s. And Nona was sort of the songwriter of the group and also probably the most political of the group. And then there was Betty Davis, who was an early 70s funk star on the downtown New York scene. And for Nev, you know, he was a little harder for me to put my finger on because he was such a chameleon. But in terms of his physical look, his aesthetic, you know, I was thinking about David Bowie. I was thinking about Elton John. I, you know, was thinking about kind of singer-songwriter types and some of the Laurel Canyon folks. So both of them are amalgamations of real people that I am a fan of.
You describe Opal as being idolized by weird black girls. And I'm wondering if you saw yourself as a weird black girl when you were growing up.
You know, I think when I was growing up, I did, because I was really from a family who were music lovers. You know, my grandparents loved jazz artists, and my parents were into conscious soul, Marvin Gaye, Stevie Wonder. So I had a wonderful grounding in Black American music of all forms, and I loved all of that. And when I was a teenager, my curiosity went different places. So, you know, this was in the early 90s when Nirvana broke through and changed absolutely everything. And I was drawn to that music because it felt taboo to me. It felt exciting to me and a little bit scary to me in a way that was strangely appealing. Alternative rock, indie rock, and a lot of music out of the UK. And The problem with that was that I, you know, rarely saw myself reflected in it. And there was, in my hometown, there was an all-ages dance club that played a lot of this music. And I was often one of the only Black girls there, you know, usually was the only Black girl there. And that was difficult for me. And it had me sort of questioning who I was. But then years later, I went to an HBCU. I went to Florida A&M. And when I was there, I discovered that it wasn't so weird after all. You know, I was in this diversity of Blackness and discovered that we all kind of had quirks and liked different things. And I met, you know, a friend who eventually became a roommate who was the biggest Tori Amos fan I ever met, for instance. And, you know, it was just interesting to understand that I wasn't so weird after all, even though I felt that way when I was growing up.
That you were allowed to like what you like.
Exactly. You can like what you like, and it doesn't change you. It doesn't change who you are. It doesn't change your pride in being Black. It doesn't change your connections to Blackness. It just is what it is.
The story is basically, it's an oral history, the way you tell it in your novel. And all the characters from this music duo's lives are interviewed, and they get to tell their story from their perspective, and the points of view sometimes align and sometimes they don't. Sometimes they don't agree about things that happen. But meanwhile, Sonny, the main character who's writing this and who's the first Black music editor of a Rolling Stone-like music publication, she's writing the book to find out how her father was killed at a record label showcase featuring the duo Opal and Nev. He was the drummer for the band. And a fight breaks out when a Southern band that wears Confederate flags on its jackets and Confederate flags on the drum kit, the band's frontman has a Confederate flag as a cape. There's a lot of bikers who are their fans in the audience for this music showcase that both Opal and Nev and the Southern band are on the bill for. Long story, but a big fight breaks out. And in that fight, the music editor's father, the drummer in the band, is killed. Especially where we are now with Confederate flags finally coming down and Confederate monuments coming down or at least being questioned. But many of, you know, many have come down. It's really interesting to go back to, say, the early 70s when this novel takes place, and the head of the record company can say, yeah, I just thought of Confederate flags as like another slice of Americana.
Right.
When you were writing this novel, did you go back and look at Southern bands from the 70s that actually wore Confederate flag as part of their clothing or, you know, put Confederate flags on their amps?
So really, I was thinking about Lynyrd Skynyrd.
And yeah,
Lynyrd Skynyrd, yes. So yeah. They are from Jacksonville.
Which is where you're from.
That is where I'm from. And they went to Robert E. Lee High, which was the high school I would have been zoned to go to, except I went to a public magnet school. And Lynyrd Skynyrd, where I'm from, were huge. You know, you would go to any kind of concert and people would just start randomly screaming Free Bird. You know, the Confederate flag was really, you know, growing up, you would see it everywhere. You would see it in gas stations on keychains at the front counter. You would see it on bikinis at the beach, you know. And I have the record label head, Howie, in the book talking about, yeah, he thought it was just another slice of Americana because it's shown in Gone with the Wind. It's on the General Lee, the car that's the star basically of the Dukes of Hazzard. And I remember being young and watching the Dukes of Hazzard with my cousins and not knowing what that thing was on the top of the car, and my parents not wanting to like lay all this heavy stuff on me about what it meant, you know, and wondering why they seemed a little uncomfortable with us watching the Dukes of Hazzard. And it was all things that I grappled with when I got older and actually when I left the South, when I lived in other places and would see it.
After the riot breaks out at this music showcase and bikers who have come to see this Southern rock band start really doing damage, the drummer for Opal and Nev is killed. And the music journalist writing this oral history is his daughter. So part of why she's writing this history is to learn more about who her father was and how he died, because her mother was pregnant with her when her father died. So she never really got to meet him. After this horrible incident, Opal, who was injured in that incident, is really shaken and feels partly responsible for what happened. And she writes a song called "Who's the N-Word Now?" I mean, she uses the word in the song. And again, this is 1970. So tell us about that song and why you wanted her to write it.
Well, it's actually it's a collaboration between her and Nev. This is the point where before the riot, Nev has been the songwriter and Opal has been his featured singer. You know, she mostly sings background vocals and she occasionally takes the lead on the song. But this is the first time that lyrically they've kind of worked together on a song. And I think what happens is Opal and Nev come into Rivington Showcase, which is this concert. They come into it one way and they leave it greatly changed. For Opal, I think it is a moment of politicization. She has been traumatized. She is also very angry. And I think that she leans into those things. She leans into those feelings. And the song, you know, I only have a couple of lyrics in the book, but it's in the story song tradition that Nev writes, but it is a bit of a revenge fantasy, the song. And I think Opal is really in this moment grappling with who she's going to be as an artist. What feels authentic to her is to come out of this tragedy, this moment, really saying something provocative. And I think that's what it is for her. You know, the N-word is one that is flung around at the Rivington Showcase. And this is the way of sort of turning it on its head through this song and making a very big splash with it.
This song is basically saying, I've got the power, I've got the weapon, so who's the N-word now? But there's a point where Sunny, the main character who is writing this oral history, where she thinks, and Sunny is the first black editor of the music magazine, she thinks no matter how much Opal and Nev presented themselves as politically aware auteurs in the wake of Sunny's father's death, the fact remained that their art had exploited black pain.
Mm-hmm.
Now, mm-hmm. She comes to kind of question that perception, but can you talk a little bit about that idea of, you know, artists exploiting black pain?
Yeah. So I think with Sunny, who is a journalist and thus a little skeptical, a little analytical, I think what she's seeing is, you know, before this moment, before this concert, Opal and Nev weren't making very much of a splash at all. They weren't selling very well. Their concerts weren't well attended. Their label was on the brink of dropping them. And then there's this incident in which her father is killed, a very serious headline-grabbing moment. And she sees them as sort of using that, right? And I think there's two different ways of looking at that. I think for Opal, it is, again, this is me being authentic and actually speaking on these issues that I've witnessed firsthand. For Sunny, it's more like, okay, well, this is how you got very famous, right? After this moment, like this is the thing that put you into the spotlight and you continue to lean on it. You continue to lean on the provocative and this very violent moment in which I, you know, lost my father and never got to know my father. And so what does that mean? And it's very complicated. You know, Sunny has incredibly complex feelings toward Opal. She both admires her and is a little bit queasy thinking about the ways in which Opal sort of uses this moment to seize the spotlight.
So Opal is a kind of proto-Afrofuturist as a performer. And Afrofuturism has become like really popular. And I'm wondering if you're kind of hooked into that and what it represents to you.
You know, I don't know a whole lot about it. I find it fascinating, though. And I think anything in which like Black people are dreaming, I think is just fantastic. And like imagination opening up and possibilities, I think that's hugely exciting. And I think how it manifests in Opal is just, it's all, she's someone who is, she dares to dream very radically, and she dares to demand that there will be better and smarter and all of those things. And I think that throughout her life, she's always someone who's a few steps ahead, you know, ahead of her time. And that's how I wanted to present her.
So you took a big leap, leaving a steady job as a magazine editor to become a novelist. You went back to school. You studied at the Iowa Writers' Workshop. What was the turning point for you that made you decide this was a perforation point? You were going to leave the security of a job and write a novel.
I started writing this novel in 2013 at the point, you know, I was working at Essence. I was the deputy managing editor there, and it was a huge job with very long days. And I was also at the time going through some personal changes at home. You know, I had been married before and was going through a divorce at the time and was really questioning so many things about my life. You know, for so many years, I had been kind of on the straight and narrow in terms of my career. I went to undergraduate school for journalism. And, you know, even in high school, I worked on my school newspaper, and I was just sort of plugging away at that and climbing up the ladder. And by the time I was sort of reaching the top of that ladder, I still had a little nagging dissatisfaction. As much as I loved working at Essence, it was such a wonderful and supportive place. I was meeting, as part of that job, so often like the incredible Black women, you know, who we would cover in the magazine or feature at the festival. And these were women who were doing amazing things to make their dreams come true. And I think a lot of that spirit kind of rubbed off on me. And when I was going through, you know, that divorce and kind of reassessing my life, I was like, well, you know, I've made the nest. I have this nest egg. And what do I want to do with the rest of my life? And I had been writing on the sort of edges of my day, you know, waking up at 5 in the morning, staying up sometimes if I had the energy after work to plug away. And I just thought, you know, maybe there's something here. Maybe it's time to do something completely selfish and just take this risk.
Your novel is written in the form of an oral history. One of the brilliant things about using that as a form is that every story is self-contained. You don't have to get people in and out of rooms. You don't have to make transitions, you know, between paragraphs, in the sense that, like, somebody talks, then somebody else talks. And it just eliminates a lot of problems.
Yeah. Thanks for revealing my secret, Terry. Yeah, you know, and when I brought it in, you know, people were like, oh, I don't know how you can write like this. It seems so hard and so structured, but I actually found it very freeing. And it was probably, of all the things that I've written, because I've written some short fiction here and there, and now I'm trying to work on something new that is, of course, not this form. I found it very freeing to allow just the characters to be wild and raw, and to just get down exactly what they would say. And just, it was the thing that, like, I was able to make it flow. Like, I could write, you know, regularly 1,000 words a day very easily.
Is it ever a relief to you not having anybody reporting to you, not editing other people's work, not having to report to somebody above you, and just like write what you want to write. Yeah.
Yes. It's very freeing. I have to say I'm really enjoying this phase of my life. I'm very grateful to my journalism career. I actually credit my journalism career for helping me to write this book, because there's so much of that career in this book. There's the form itself of the oral history. There's, you know, the Sunny character, the journalist. All of those things really informed a lot of what was on my mind and on my heart. And I feel like, you know, I'm going to be 45 in June, and I'm finally like playing. I'm having so much fun.
I'm glad to hear that. Donnie Walton, it's been a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Terry.
Donnie Walton is the author of the new novel, The Final Revival of Opal and Nev. Our book critic, Maureen Corrigan, says that by trade, writers are paranoid people. They spend too much time in their own heads, many of them worried about whether the work of other writers garners more sales and recognition. Here's Maureen's review of two new literary suspense tales that amp up the anxiety.
This spring, a wave of suspense stories is breaking, whose plots center on struggling writers stealing someone else's work. But these novels are more socially aware than the traditional "who wrote it" tales of literary paranoia. In many of these stories, power imbalances rooted in gender or class tempt malefactors into thinking they're justified in stealing someone else's voice and story. Two of the best have just been published in time for early summer reading. A Lonely Man is a brooding literary thriller by Chris Power that explores human betrayal in all its infinite variety, and it's also reminiscent of the Graham Greene classic, The Third Man. The story opens one evening in a Berlin bookstore. Two men, both British, both writers, are browsing and reach for the same book. Robert is a married father of two. Some years ago, he published a respectfully reviewed short story collection, and ever since, he's been trying to write his first novel. Accent on the word trying. The other man, Patrick, is a ghostwriter whose last client was a Russian oligarch who'd hired Patrick to write his memoirs, filled with information damaging to Vladimir Putin. That writing project came to a halt the morning the oligarch went out for a run and was subsequently discovered hanging from an oak tree. The death was ruled a suicide, but Patrick insists it was murder. Robert and Patrick begin meeting for drinks, and as Patrick unbends, he tells Robert he's being followed, probably by the same pro-Putin thugs who murdered his former employer. As Robert listens, he feels tempted to steal a story that would otherwise go to waste. Robert begins manipulating Patrick into sharing detailed accounts of his interviews with the doomed oligarch. It's all going so well until Robert is grimly reminded that in laying claim to Patrick's material, he too has turned into a writer who knows too much. Jean Hanf Korolitz is the novelist who gave us the 2014 domestic thriller You Should Have Known, which was made into the recent HBO series The Undoing, in which the online buzz over Nicole Kidman's gorgeous coats threatened to distract attention from the diabolical narrative. Korolitz's new novel is called The Plot, and it's an ingenious, witty nightmare of a thriller about the dangerous consequences of sticky fingers in the literary world. The protagonist of The Plot is Jacob Finch Bonner, a once-celebrated young author who, by his own admission, fumbled his early shot, fail to produce a good enough second novel or any trace of a third novel, and had been sent to the special purgatory for formerly promising writers. That special purgatory is a low residency Masters of Fine Arts program at the fictional Ripley College in Vermont, where for the past few summers, Jacob has taught a prose fiction workshop. To say that Jacob has become cynical about teaching would be like saying that Ulysses takes a long time to get home. When the story opens, Jacob has just arrived at his temporary office on campus without having read his new students' writing samples. Because, after all, thinks Jacob, what was there to know? These particular students, these ardent apprentices, would be utterly indistinguishable from their earlier Ripley counterparts. Mid-career professionals convinced they could churn out Clive Cussler adventures, or moms who blogged about their kids and didn't see why that shouldn't entitle them to a regular gig on Good Morning America, or newly retired people returning to fiction, secure in the knowledge that fiction had been waiting for them. But as fate would have it, there is one special student in the summer seminar, an arrogant toad named Evan Parker, who refuses to share his work with the class, but does break down and share his spectacular plot idea with Jacob. Years later, when Jacob has slid even farther down the literary food chain and is working as a freelance writing coach, he becomes curious about whatever happened to Parker and his great idea for a novel. To his shock, Jacob discovers Parker's obituary online. There's no novel because Parker didn't live to write it. But Jacob is alive. And it would be a crime to let that spectacular story vanish into the ether, wouldn't it? I'll stop there, because one thing that surely would be a crime would be to divulge any more of the malevolent twists and turns of the plot. The plot of the plot is so inspired that it should be assigned as required reading in the very MFA programs it satirizes, both as a model of narrative construction and as a warning to wannabe writers that purloined letters are an ever-present danger of the literary life.
Maureen Carrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed A Lonely Man by Chris Power and The Plot by Jean Hanth Korolitz. June 19th will mark the 156th anniversary of Juneteenth, commemorating the day slavery was ended in Texas in 1865. Juneteenth is now a state holiday in Texas and seems to be on the way to becoming a national holiday. It's a holiday in conversation with July 4th, which celebrates America gaining its independence, but enslaved people remained in bondage. My guest, Annette Gordon Reed, is a Pulitzer Prize-winning historian and Harvard professor who has written a new book called On Juneteenth. It's part history, part memoir. She's from East Texas. She's a historian of slavery and the early American Republic. Her other books include Thomas Jefferson and Sally Hemings, An American Controversy, and The Hemings of Monticello, An American Family. She edited the book Race on Trial, Law and Justice in American History. Annette Gordon Reed, welcome to Fresh Air. I learned a lot that I'm really happy I learned from your new book. So let me ask you to give a fuller version of what Juneteenth represents.
Well, Juneteenth represents the end of slavery, technically the end of slavery in Texas in 1865, and it has been a day to commemorate what we know, and we know from the way they acted, the joy of people who were enslaved in Texas when they heard the news that slavery was over. And being treated as chattel, those days were behind them. And they were supposed to be then go forward as equal people in the place where they lived.
So how does June 19th, 1865 fit into the end of slavery, the abolition of slavery in the U.S.?
Well, it was, emancipation was a process. There was not any one day that made everything okay, made it all over until we get to the ratification of the 13th Amendment, which was in December of 1865. But what happens in Texas is there was a delay from when the Emancipation Proclamation was put forth and when Lee surrendered at Appomattox in April of 1865. The Army of the Trans-Mississippi kept fighting. And the last battle of the Civil War was in Texas, and actually the Confederates won. But it was at that time that Gordon Granger was able to go to Texas, go to Galveston, and make this announcement that slavery was over in the largest state of the Union. So it was a part of the process of emancipation.
So we'll get a little deeper into the history later in the interview. But first, I want to talk with you a little bit about how the holiday has been celebrated in your family. How was it celebrated when you were growing up?
Well, it was sort of a precursor to July 4th. It was a day of barbecuing. It was a day for us kids to run around and drink a lot of what we call soda water, which means soda pop, I guess in the Northeast they say, and throw firecrackers. We were with our friends and with our families, and it was time sometimes to go on picnics. So it was a celebration. It was a day when adults came and sometimes took the day off and shared it with us. So it was sort of like, a wind up to July 4th, but it was mainly celebrated by Black people when I was growing up.
When you were growing up and your family celebrated Juneteenth, did they also talk with you about the meaning of Juneteenth?
Yes, sometimes they did, and I asked about it. My great-grandmother was alive until I was about 11 years old, and I wish I'd talked to her more about these things, but she talked about what it meant to people to have slavery ended. Her mother had been enslaved as a young girl and had been freed by her father along with her mother, and so she knew someone who had been enslaved, and her mother had married a man who was enslaved until the end of, the Civil War. So this was very, very close to us. This is not very far in the past at all. And she talked about what it meant and said that it meant a lot to people. The day meant a lot. Even though there were still struggles afterwards, the day meant a great deal to them.
Do you see Juneteenth as being in conversation with July 4th?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. It reminds people that the sort of vaulting and high ideals of the Declaration of Independence about equality, the equality of mankind, were not in operation, and that it took war and Civil War amendments to bring all of this to fruition. And we're still working on it right now, but you think about the two of them together, and we thought about the two of them together.
Let's get into some of the history. Texas didn't surrender in the Civil War until 2 years after the Emancipation Proclamation.
Mm-hmm.
Why did Texas continue to fight even after Robert E. Lee surrendered?
I guess you could put it to stubbornness. I talk a little bit in the book about Texas's unique situation. It had been a republic, its own republic, for almost a decade, and thought of itself as special. They had not been defeated in battle in the Civil War, and they thought they had a chance to do it. The state was founded, the area first as the territory, all of this was founded as a slaveholder's republic, and they kept fighting because they believed that this was vital to their future, and they had been successful in the battles and decided to keep going with it. But it was mainly the sort of stubbornness of Texans that in some ways people see as a positive thing, but in that situation was not so great.
So a U.S. Army General, Gordon Granger, was given the job of getting Texas to announce that enslaved people were now free. And not only to announce it, but to actually enact it. So Granger prepared what was called General Order Number 3, ending legalized slavery in Texas. Would you describe what's in General Order Number 3?
Well, it's not a very long document. It just announces the end of slavery, and he does something that is quite extraordinary. He also suggests that now, after the end of slavery, the people who had been enslaved would occupy, and I'm paraphrasing here, the sort of same plane of equality with their former enslavers. And so he really didn't have to say that. He could have just said, the slaves are now free, slavery's over, and that's it. But he begins to talk about what life would be like after that. And he raised, obviously, expectations on the part of enslaved people, but he also enraged whites who began to think, you know, what is this? We held these people as chattel before, and now he's saying that they're going to be equal to us. And I think that's interesting because it harkens back to Lincoln's Emancipation Proclamation, and Lincoln was very much enamored of the Declaration of Independence and saw it as sort of expressing the ideals of America. So we see echoes of Lincoln, echoes of, you know, Jefferson's Declaration, the American Declaration, in this order, in its focus on the notion of equality going forward.
Yeah, I want to quote from it because it declares absolute equality of personal rights and rights of property between former masters and slaves. That upset a lot of white people. There was a wave of white violence afterwards. What was that wave of violence like?
Well, there are stories about people who were celebrating what they called the Jubilee or Emancipation Day before it became Juneteenth, and they were whipped. They were whipped for doing it. They were punished for doing it. So it was a time of being very hopeful and excitement on the part of one group of people, but resentment and recalcitrance on the part of many whites. Now, there were whites who, obviously, the army went around Galveston and then in the outlying areas, wherever they could, you know, saying this and making this the story known. But for the most part, it was a very, very tense time, hope and at the same time, hostility.
You know, you point out that in pop culture, the images of Texas are all about like cowboys and ranchers and farmers and oilmen. But Texas was, at least part of Texas, was all about plantations and enslaved people. And I didn't realize how much of Texas's deep history was about making sure that slavery could be legal. So let's go back to a very early chapter in Texas, when Stephen Austin, who was born in Virginia and raised in Missouri, came to Texas when it was a province of Mexico. What did he want to do in Texas? Why did he come to Texas?
Well, it started out with his father, Moses, who passed away, and he sort of took up the mantle of his father. They wanted to bring settlers, Anglo settlers, into Texas to extend the cotton empire that was becoming more important to the economy during that time. Texas had great land for that, for cotton and for sugar cane, which became the real crops of that time. And Mexico had really an ambivalent attitude about slavery. At one point, they had outlawed slavery. They were pretty lenient with the Texas settlers on this question, but they were equivocating on this point. And because these were people who were coming from Alabama, white people who were coming from Alabama and Georgia, from the Southeast, coming to this place, they wanted to make sure that their property rights in enslaved people would be protected. So there was always this insecurity about being with the Mexicans and the Mexican government that might at some point decide that they were going to turn on them on this question of slavery. So, yeah, the people who came to East Texas, the most populous part of the state, were there to be farmers, to be plantation owners, and they wanted enslaved labor to make this work.
So at the time, Stephen Austin, and Austin, Texas is named after him. Mm-hmm. So at the time he comes to Texas, Texas is a province of Mexico?
It is a province of Mexico.
So what did that mean? What was the relationship of Texas and Mexico?
Well, it's like a state of like we have states today. It was a state in Mexico. There was a Mexican government controlled. Mexican law was paramount, and they wanted Anglo settlers to sort of balance out the competition with indigenous people who were there. The Comanche were fighting, you know, to preserve their land, and they thought that Anglo settlers would come and they would sort of join the fight and be on their side. So at first, they welcomed them. The Mexicans welcomed Anglo settlers for this reason, so that they could have more people to play against the Comanches and Apaches and others who were indigenous people who were in that area. So it was friendly at first, but when Mexicans began to, they changed the Constitution, they suspended the Constitution at one point and began to make noises about slavery, the Texans, the Texians, as they were called, decided that it would be better off if they were a republic on their own, if they could just go on their own and continue to bring settlers in, Anglo settlers, turn it into a cotton empire so that it would be as prosperous as places like Louisiana, Mississippi, and Alabama were, and Georgia growing cotton.
So when Mexico starts to turn against slavery, that's when the leaders of Texas decided we should become independent to preserve slavery.
Yes, that was one of the things, preserving slavery, but also concerns about the Constitution, changing other aspects of the Constitution. These were two different cultures, different languages, you know, they were spoken, and there was tension. Slavery was a big part of it, but there were other tensions as well about who would rule. And the Texians wanted to be on their own.
Your family has deep roots in Texas. Your father's side of the family came to Texas sometime in the 1860s. Do you know whether that was before or after the Civil War?
I don't.
Did they come as enslaved people, or did they?
I think they came. They came as enslaved people. Mm-hmm. They came. My father's family came as enslaved people. On my mother's side, I can go back to the 1820s, and those were certainly enslaved people who were brought to Texas from Georgia in one case and Alabama in another.
Did they pass on any stories about the wave of violence after Texas was forced to free enslaved people?
No, they did not. The stories that I heard were more about the 20th century. examples of violence, things that had happened specifically to people they knew or in their specific area. There was no question that we understood that the Klan had a long history and Knight Riders and so forth, but enough horrific things happened in the 20th century that they fixated on those things much more so than in the immediate aftermath of the Civil War.
I want to end the interview by going back to Juneteenth, which is the subject of your new book. Juneteenth is a Texas holiday. It's a state holiday right now. What would it take for it to become a national holiday?
Well, Congress would have to accept it, and people would have to think that it was important enough, central enough to the United States. And apparently, I think that there may be three states now who don't have some form of recognition of it. So it seems to be on its way. I know that there are people who have other candidates, maybe the Emancipation Proclamation, maybe January 1st, maybe what we said before about the ratification of the 13th Amendment in December. But we'll see what happens with it.
How important to you is it to have a national holiday that recognizes the emancipation of slaves?
I think it's very important. My father used to joke, and I don't know how much he was joking, he would say the slaves haven't been freed. What he was talking about is that there's still a long struggle for African Americans. He knows that there have been advances and progress and so forth. But I think there ought to be a day to remember what it must have felt like for people who had been treated as property, who feared more than anything the loss of relatives and family members because they were seen as property through sale, through inheritance, the normal operations of the property system, that they lived under the vagaries of all of that. And there was great joy, a great sense of release, and a great sense of hope that existed in those people. And I think one of the ways we can honor that would be to have a day to think about and reflect on what their circumstances were like and what they hoped would happen in the future for their descendants.
Annette Gordon-Reed, it's been a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you for so much enlightening information about American history.
Thank you for having me.
Annette Gordon-Reed's new book is called On Juneteenth,